might is right. Power, power, with your host, Bill Rye.
Welcome to the Might is Right Network at mightisright.net for the Might is Right Power Hour podcast. I'm Bill Rise, and it's Thursday, August 20th, 2015. All right, for this episode of the Might is Right Power Hour, I am pleased to have a very special guest, and that guest is Carolyn Yeager. Now, Carolyn Yeager, due to her devotion
and
tenacity, has become a well-known figure in our part of the alternative media. I think for about 8 years now, somewhere around there, Carolyn Yeager has been doing podcasts, writing, doing research. She specializes in World War II, National Socialist Germany, Adolf Hitler, Holocaust revisionism. Yes, history needs to be revised so as to reflect the truth rather than a bunch of Jew holohoax lies. She wrote a 48-page booklet also titled Auschwitz, The Underground Tour, What the Tour Guides Don't Tell You. And I have that link in the description box over at TalkShoe. Carolyn Yeager has written many articles and done podcasts that expose that lying snake, Elie Wiesel. Oh, I hate that bastard. The world's most infamous holohoax liar or survivor. And Carolyn Yeager wrote a very good article that exposes the absurd tale that we've all heard that claims that Hitler was part Jewish. Even people within the struggle that have bought into that. And that article is titled The Fake Legends of Adolf Hitler's Jewish Grandfather, How and Why It Got Started and Why It's Not True. I know that in sales they call it throwing shit on the wall, trying all different approaches and see what sticks. Well, they do that with National Socialism, Hitler, all sorts of bullcrap out there that contradicts this thing and that thing, but They want to see what sticks. Carolyn Yeager explores, investigates, and comments on contemporary issues as well. For example, she introduced some realism and sanity into the debate surrounding Putin. There are those within the struggle that idolize Putin as if he's some kind of white savior. And these same gullible types are now praising that snake, Donald Trump. There's also a very good series of podcasts Carolyn Yeager did where she interviewed various movement leaders, such as, let's see, there was Alex Linder, Tom Metzger, Severus Nicholson, and many others. So I appreciate Carolyn Yeager's work, her contribution to the white movement or struggle, as I call it. She does a real good job exposing Jews, and I consider Carolyn Yeager to be one of the most sincere and honest individuals in the white struggle. So, lowbrow Bill and Carolyn Yeager are going to be on the same podcast. Perhaps she can elevate my brow, at least for this evening. Carolyn Yeager's main site is at carolynyeager.net, and that'll be linked also in the description box. And you can find most of her work right there or be led to it from there. Okay, I'm going to bring up Carolyn Yeager. Welcome her to the Might is Right Network and the Might is Right Power Hour. Here we go. Do I have you? Hello?
Hello, Bill. Okay, well, here we are.
Maybe we can dig right in and I'll ask the first question. How do you view your role within the white struggle or movement? Is there a specific goal that you have in mind, a focus, something specific that you want to accomplish?
Well, my role, I think I have played a very positive role in the movement, and my overriding goal has always been to help the German historical record, and that's why I involve myself in Holocaust, Hitler, and National Socialism, and things like that, and that has never faded. I mean, that has never flagged so that something else has become more important, but I have involved myself in other issues. And when I started spending time on the Internet, and that was really not until 2004, I would say, when I, you know, really spent quite a bit of time on the Internet. And that's what appealed to me the most. I was reading about a lot of conspiracy stuff in 9/11, naturally. But then I found that there was some information about the Holocaust and even National Socialism. And it was just, like, thrilling to me. I felt this kind of inner thrill and happiness that National Socialism could be seen as a good thing. And I was reading, I got on some forum that some guys were talking about National Socialism in a real positive way and discussing it, and other people were trying to tear it down. But I just thought, wow, this is just, it just moved me so much and made me very, very happy inside. So I don't think I had ever come across that before. It was always like, you know, bad news, which I never accepted fully. You know, I believed in the Holocaust, and I believed Hitler must have done the things they said, but I never felt like I wanted to condemn them, you know, condemn him for it, or that I felt angry, or that I was anti-Hitler or something like that. And then you mentioned Elie Wiesel site, and, you know, all the work that I put into that Elie Wiesel site, which is called Elie Wiesel Cons the World, and the kind of things that I have on the sidebar at CarolynYeager.net really shows what my primary interest is.
Right.
You know, and what I want to leave behind as a, what do you call that? What I want.
Legacy?
Yeah, legacy. As something that I hope to keep my website up for a long time with somebody looking after it, so that it'll just be there, that the information that I have accumulated there.
Right. Some people, they don't seem to understand the importance of that time frame and those events, you know, World War II, even before that, the 20s, the 30s in Germany. some people, especially some of the younger people, will say, well, that's old news, but a lot of what's going on today came out of that. And also,
it's the key period. It's when things change. You can go back further, of course. You can always do that. But that is the key period. 1945 and that Nuremberg trial set the rules for what the world was going to be and what we were going to believe. That's what has to be undone. And I believe, a lot of people don't agree, as you just pointed out, but I definitely, absolutely, sincerely believe that we can't make the progress, the real progress, we can't change things until we undo that, change that.
And it's clearly important to the Jews. They keep propping it up. It's very important. Any time that whites stick up for themselves, right away, we're haters. We're Nazis. We're about to kill how many? Six, you know, it protects them from criticism. You know, so it's clearly important to them to this day. It's like the foundation of all their anti-white propaganda.
Yeah, well, it is. Yeah, and a lot of people point that out, and that's clear. But it's that, and it's the whole world, though. It's all our governments. It's not just the Jews, although you can say that the Jews are controlling all of that, and in large part they do, but there's also an interest. Well, you know, I really have come to see it as a communism. I mean, I know I believed, you know, communism was over with, and anybody would talk about communism after the fall of the Soviet Union, well, that's just so silly and blah, blah. But more and more, that's what I call it. It's a Soviet-type system that we became familiar with under Stalin, and it's just a global setup is going to be like that. It's not going to be under Stalin, but it's under these globalists who want total control over people who have no ability to resist.
Yeah, and so far they're using like a softer approach, but the actual agenda is rather harsh. But I was going to ask you, would you describe yourself as a national socialist? And if so, you know, what does that mean to you, being a national socialist?
You know, that's kind of a hard one to explain and to even understand for myself, because I asked myself, you know, am I a national socialist? Well, now I have for some time now been calling myself a national socialist. I don't go around calling myself that, but if I'm asked, you know, I say I'm a national socialist by conviction. But I identify National Socialism with the NSDAP in Germany and Hitler's National Socialism. And I don't identify as some kind of an American National Socialist. And I haven't seen any American National Socialism that I would want to be a part of. I think National Socialism requires a real nation. And I don't think the United States is a real nation. So, go ahead.
I see nation. And there's different definitions, but the definition that used to be used many, many decades ago would be people, okay? So a country like Japan, you could say, you know, they could almost be interchangeable. It's a country and it's a nation, right? But here in the United States, and now all of our countries, white-founded countries, are being flooded with non-whites, but especially here in the United States, there are many nations, you know? As in many different people, not just the old Mongoloid Indian nations like Cherokee and all that, but blacks, you know, Negroids, mestizos, and so forth. So that's how I look at nation and nationalism. You know, I distinguish the type that is just keyed to a country more than tribe. So if I say, I don't usually call myself a nationalist, but I'm fine with it, white nationalist. As in people, though, not as in I'm loyal to this country. I'm certainly not.
Well, yeah, then you have to know what people you're talking about, right? Nation is a group of people who have a common race and ethnicity and have common cultural values. Going back, have common language and all of that, and who can identify with one another. So that,
well,
I think, is a requirement.
Right. What do you think about this attitude, that there was a nation here? Now, of course, even going way back, there was the slaves here, right, the blacks. and then later some Japanese and Chinese, but for the most part, until the 60s, you know, 90%+ white. So I believe that there was an American people here, as in nationhood, an American nation. So I'm not ready to give up on that. When things get real hot, I believe it's going to be like Civil War II. There's going to be many, many factions, a lot of chaos, but I think we should try and have the attitude to take or keep as much of this country as we can, and that as white people, we should consider ourselves Americans, and that we used to have a culture, and the world saw it that way too, and understood Americans and who they were, and they were white.
Sure, we could have an American nation, but we don't have one now.
No, we don't now.
And people have a hard time relating to such an idea of a white American nation.
Well, we have it in my mind, and there's others out there. Most white Americans don't see it that way. They see it more in tune with being connected to a piece of paper, like the Constitution, and they see it as American means equality and nigger ball games and stuff in your face full of Cheetos. Consumerism, yeah.
Well, I'll just say that I don't know if it's good or not good. If so many men are saying, I don't know if there's so many, but where I go and look, there's a lot there. You know, it's alternative sites who call themselves National Socialists. And then sometimes they describe, or something comes up, it's discussed a little bit, and their idea of National Socialism is not my idea of National Socialism, and it's not, I don't even think it's Adolf Hitler's idea of National Socialism. So how do you, you know, what does National Socialism mean to you? And I think you said, I think you consider yourself National Socialist?
No, I don't. I would never call myself a National Socialist. I don't know.
You don't call yourself a Nationalist either.
I said I don't typically do that. I'll say right out, I'm a racialist or a racist. But, you know, it's that Orwellian thing where certain definitions go down the memory hole and new things are added. They added a section in there where it's a non-scientific view of race. Well, by the older definitions, that wasn't in there. So I'm a racist by older definitions, or I'll say racialist might describe somebody with a little bit more understanding than just saying, well, I don't like black people, right? But if somebody says white nationalist to me, I'm not going to say, oh, I'm not a white nationalist. That's close enough. I look at it as in white people, white nationalists like that. But when it comes to National Socialism, how would I define it? I wouldn't be able to. That's why I asked you, since you're more knowledgeable on the subject, because I read Mein Kampf, and I've run across people on the internet who say they're National Socialists, and most of them really don't know what that means. They just think Hitler was cool, you know?
Well, that's right, and that's kind of what I'm saying. And so that discouraged, well, maybe I'm too easily discouraged, but I guess it's a good thing that they think they like National Socialism. But it bothers me when people are spouting off things and they don't really understand, and they don't even try to learn more about it, or if they do, they have a different idea than what I think it really is. And so,
well, could you describe it in like a paragraph or two, what you think it is?
Well,
what
I think
it should be?
What it was in National Socialist Germany.
I know, but describe that for us a little bit.
Well, it was a people who consider themselves one national entity, who speak the same language and have the same cultural background. And National Socialism was to combine the idea of nationalism and socialism, that we're gonna go the extra step to take care of our own people. But only our own people. We're not going to be. It's just the opposite of international socialism. And nationalism, the opposite of internationalism. So it changes who the socialism is being carried out for. So it's caring for your own people and doing things for them, not saying, oh, well, we have to have a hardcore, free enterprise system here, but there's a welfare. But, you know, now here's another thing about National Socialism and where it's at, that people are different. And everybody knows that Germans are different from, say, Italians, or I like Italians, or some Balkan nations. So if you're going to have a National Socialist in Germany, you're going to have disciplined people carrying it out, and if you're going to have a national socialism somewhere else, it might not be so disciplined, it's not going to work as well.
Right. The way I looked at national socialism, if I were to just describe it, you know, briefly, would be, like you said, with a people, right? One people, one language, and all that, where the government is set up solely to look after the interest of that people that they represent, and pretty much anything can be interfered with, including the economy, the social structures, to the benefit of the people, or interfered with if there's something destructive. So it's just all about the people and whatever is required.
It's all about the people, but it's the leaders who determine, who
right.
decide what's good for the people, because it's not a populist system,
right.
really.
Right, you'd have to have the best people in leadership positions.
You have to have leadership that is sincere and really cares about the people, and that's its goal, to help the nation and the people to be as free and as sovereign and as well off as possible. It's not people who are in it for themselves or to make themselves rich. That's the difference.
That's why I think something similar to that, it doesn't have to be called National Socialism, can occur in any white-founded country, including here in America. All it takes is the right leadership, and obviously having territory, let's say here, for example, whatever territory we're able to garner, cleansed of everyone who's not white, because there is American traditions, there was, you know, American culture in the past. We do have the same language, you know.
No, you're right. That's maybe the problem with talking about National Socialism, is though whatever is like that has to be called National Socialism, which then connects you with Adolf Hitler and Germany and the Third Reich. But it doesn't have to be called that. It's just any kind of good government for a people that sees itself as a people, and the government is there for the people.
Yeah. That's a good two-word description, good government.
Yeah.
Well, there's more to it than that, but because good society, you know, is more than just government, but you know what I mean. Good leadership. When the National Socialists came to power in Germany in 1933, you know better than I do, they inherited a country that was a basket case. There was a worldwide severe economic depression going on. I believe Jewish created, but it was even worse in Germany, the situation. Could you highlight some of the accomplishments of Hitler and the National Socialist-dominated government that came to power then?
Well, it's always good to remind everyone about the great economic miracle in Germany at that time, and Hitler wanted to liberate Germany from the shackles of international loan capitalism. And he also wanted to free it from the dictate of the Versailles Treaty. So he actually put it that as long as the international monetary system was based on gold, a nation which cornered gold could impose its will on those who lacked it. And, of course, Germany lacked it, and Germany was suffering for that reason. And he said that you could dry up, the people that had the gold could corner it and could dry up the sources of exchange and compel others to accept loans on interest in order to distribute their wealth and their production. So he said that the community of the nation does not live by the fictitious value of money, but by real production, which in its turn gives value to money. The community of the nation does not live by the fictitious value of money. That's one of the important things that economists understand about what was going on in Germany at that time, and the fact that production was the key. He said that real production gives value to money. Money doesn't give the value. So, and this production is the real cover of the currency, and it's not a bank or a safe full of gold that makes your nation wealthy or gives value to your currency. It's your ability to produce and what you do produce. He decided to first, refuse foreign interest-bearing loans and to base currency on production instead of gold. And he decided to obtain imports by direct exchange of goods, in other words, barter. and subsidize exports when necessary. So Germany was actually going about doing barter with other nations for goods because they didn't have the gold to buy it with. And three, he put a stop to what was called freedom of the exchanges. That is, he called the license to gamble in currencies and shift private fortunes from one currency to another according to the political situation, you know, people moving their money around in the world, which they still do. And he put a stop to that in Germany. And four, to create money where men and material were available for work instead of running into debt by borrowing it. That is, he created work and put people to work and used credit to do that, and then value was created from that instead of borrowing the money, instead of borrowing money. Between 1933 and 1936, he had reduced German unemployment from 6 million to 1 million, and when the whole world was in a depression, and prosperity had so far returned that in 1936, Winston Churchill is reported to have said, "Germany is getting too strong, and we must smash her." You've probably heard that phrase from Churchill.
That bastard.
So Germany was doing better than anyone else, and the others didn't like that at all. And another thing is that the National Socialists replaced the Weimar trade unions with new and improved German labor front, what they called the German labor front. And they banned strikes, sacks, and lockouts, which caused work shutdowns. And, of course, that was a big problem at the end of World War One, and Hitler was always real to how
munition strike.
Went on strike, encouraged by the communists and labor rabble-rousers, and caused Germany to have to surrender. So they set up, the National Socialists set up a Chamber of Economics, too, which integrated all the chambers of commerce the same way the labor front had absorbed the trade unions. And this was done to reduce the squabbling and fighting, you know, to get Germans of various classes to see themselves working together for the same goal. That was the overriding objective of Adolf Hitler, to bring Germans together. He even made laws so that they couldn't squabble and fight, like the labor laws. But get this, then. In June 1933, the Reinhardt Program for Infrastructure Development was introduced. Reinhardt, spelled R-E-I-N-H-A-R-D-T, you know, the same as when they talk about the Reinhardt camps later on, which were the transit camps Treblinka, Belzec, and Sobibor, which took care of collecting the valuables of the Jews before transiting them on to Russia. So these Reinhardt camps are said to be extermination camps, and they're said to be named after Reinhard Heydrich, which is so absolutely impossible that it's so stupid, it can't possibly have been. But there was a Reinhardt, everybody knows that, and he was a very important person in the economic leadership of the Reich. And so this program at these transit camps was named after him, for collecting the valuables, because it was all about the wealth of the Reich. It was all about overlooking and overseeing the wealth that belonged to the Reich, so it didn't go into anybody's hands. There was very little bribery. That's one thing about, well, that's just true about the Germans. So it worked for Hitler in his National Socialism, that people were honest. They weren't always taking things for themselves, which is the problem in so many countries, why they don't get ahead, because it's kind of lawless when that happens. But this thing about Reinhardt is really interesting. And then during the same period, 1933 to 1936, employment in construction rose from 666,000 to over 2 million, and the German motor industry boomed due to the Autobahn construction.
Yeah.
I would say that was why. And then in 1936, Hitler instituted a four-year plan with the agreement of Goering. Goering was kind of in charge of it. And the goal was to create a self-sufficient Germany by 1940. So between 1936 and 1940, they did make a lot of progress. and the plan disregarded the restrictions imposed on Germany by the Treaty of Versailles, which still remained at that time, a lot of them. So that's one of the things that was done to hold Germany back and hold it down, right, that Versailles Treaty. By 1936, Hitler just quit pretending that they were even going to follow it anymore.
It's so amazing, you know, with the world in a depression and just getting out of that whole capitalist system, you know, what you described there with the borrowing money and messing around with currencies and all that, and then looking at the wealth of your country in terms of, like you said, production, the work that can be done, the people themselves. I mean, turning that around so quickly, I mean, a lot of people were actually hungry and starving, and turning it around to where people could afford these Volkswagens and ride them on the new Autobahn and take vacations, and even things that lefties are interested in today, although the leadership of these movements is usually corrupt and not sincere, but let's say environmentalism. Hitler was big on that. There was campaigns against smoking and alcohol. I mean, it just seemed like all around a government, a leadership that really cared about the people and, you know, was very effective.
Well, you know, Hitler was a very unusual and special human being. You know, he was just way above the crowd, and he was so intelligent, and he spent his time thinking about how to make things better in Germany and how to go about it. Of course, he was spending a lot of time thinking about winning elections, but towards the end of the 1920s, and of course from 1930, 31, 32, he had committees and people working on all the various government agency type things, you know, that he would have to deal with, that he would be responsible for when, if he won, if he became chancellor, which he was sure he was going to. So he had people working on all these things, and when it came to the economy, they came up with these ideas, which had some liberal roots to them, some of them. But I read about when he realized that there was an answer to this international loan capitalism and how to get out of it, and how to make a wealthy country based on valuing production above banking and so on. He was very excited about that, and he started putting people to work looking into these things and practicing these things and so on. So, you know, he made use of all the intelligent people, all the intelligent Germans who would work with him in sincerity, you know, sincerely. He was a very serious person. He wasn't just somebody with a lot of friendly ideas or happy ideas to make people feel good. He was very, very serious, and he was very thorough, and he was very smart. Yeah, and then he was health conscious. He read about everything. You know, he was like an expert on the German Navy, along with, you know, so many other things that he knew so much about. He had the ability to remember what he read and retain everything. He would just quote long passages from things that he had read to people. And so people were really impressed by him.
And then providing the leadership and inspiration and, you know, getting himself out from under the yoke of the worldwide Jewish capitalism and whites, too. It's not all Jews, but, you know, getting himself out from under that, it was like just unleashing the productivity, the inventiveness, you know, of the people. I read some, I don't remember the titles, but some books written during that period. One of them was by an American journalist that, you know, went and traveled to Germany.
Yeah, I've been thinking about Into the Darkness.
And they were writing about all the miraculous things that were being accomplished. This was like in 37, 38. Just amazing. You know, with all the things that they came up with, I guess because they were forced to, but once you unleash the people, even when it came to fuel, didn't they come up with synthetic fuel, synthetic fibers for clothing because they weren't able to always obtain what they needed? It was just so much going on.
Germany was short of natural resources, of quite a number of them, and so they had to come up with synthetic products, and they did come up with nylon, and they did come up with, yeah, synthetic fuel. And, you know, during the war, synthetic fuel was a tremendously important industry. And when the Americans and the British, well, closer to the end than to the to earlier, realized, they didn't realize how important synthetic fuel was to the Luftwaffe. And when they did realize, they started bombing the synthetic fuel plants and places. They were making it all over Germany. They had it hidden, these places hidden away, camouflaged and so on. But they were able to, they have spies all the time, and they were able to hit quite a number of them, and it really damaged the Luftwaffe in 1944 and certainly in 1945. It's just about out of fuel. So, but yeah, what we're talking about here is someone who is working hard to make Germany the very best place it can possibly be for the German people. And you think other countries, they can do the same thing. They didn't have anybody who was trying to do that. And so instead they wanted to tear down Germany because it was doing too well.
Right. That's what I believe would have happened no matter what, even if he didn't go into Poland or anything. There was that shining example of what could be done. You know, different countries would be different degrees. I mean, the Germans were very productive people to begin with. But anyway, I don't think the Jews or just the capitalist system around the world would want anyone else to imitate what Hitler was doing and
yeah,
get out from under that yoke.
That kind of leaves you with the idea that it can never be done, because whenever anything like that comes about, it's going to be destroyed, because there's always that ugly element. How are you going to get rid of it? That element that doesn't want good things, that wants to just control kind of a system of slavery.
Well, I have ideas on that, but that'll be another podcast. I talk about that. But right now, just preparation. Anyway, with Adolf Hitler there, do you think there's anyone else that, in terms of a major country, that had challenged Jewish rule like he did at any other time?
Well, no.
Or at least in recent history, or maybe at all?
No. No,
I mean almost defeated
them. You know, that's why he's so amazing, and he's not appreciated even by white nationalists. So many white nationalists don't appreciate him. He's the only one who's ever done all these things. And then people will say today, they'll say, "Well, if he hadn't have done what he did to the Jews wouldn't have had all this power today, because everybody feels sorry for him. They were able to use that to give themselves a lot of sympathy." Well,
go ahead.
No, well, I'm just going to say, what kind of a way of thinking is that?
Well, that's the kind of way of thinking like a slave that says, I'm going to be an obedient slave. I'm not going to resist, because the last time some slaves resist, they cut our food rations or something. We need to resist. He almost was victorious. The next time, I look at it long term, there's a war going on between the Jews and the white race. Unfortunately, there's a lot of big time powerful white people siding with the Jews, and it's been going on a long time, and I don't think the final chapter's been written. We have a system that's in place here in the United States and all the white-founded countries that has within it the seeds of its own destruction. It's rotten to the core. So it will come down at some point, but there's going to be a lot of chaos and a lot of bloodshed, you know, in the process.
I'm a racialist too. I think that's a pretty good way to describe oneself. And I think that race is what counts. You know, race is what makes the difference in how people do and how people believe and what's possible. It's all in race. And so fixing our race is the worst thing that we could possibly do. And that's what they're trying to force us to do.
All right. I've heard that too from racialists and also from like regular lemming type people. That, you know, maybe you have some racist thoughts, but they'll say things like, yeah, if it wasn't for Hitler and all that, we wouldn't have all this mess today, you know. Like, we're supposed to be nice to our enemies.
Yeah, and that's going to work. As though that's going to work.
They won't be anti-white if we just lick their boots, right, and we don't resist. It's just insane. The next question here you kind of covered, or you did cover, but maybe there's something else you'd want to say. It's along those same lines when people that say they're pro-white, and then they say the Holocaust, Hitler, National Socialism, World War II, that entire period is old news, and it's counterproductive to discuss. explain.
Yeah, well, an example of that is somebody who I admire very much, and that's Kevin MacDonald. I admire him. I like him, and I like the site that he runs, and I have some criticisms of it, but I think he's one of the very best people. But he can't seem to accept that that whole Hitler business is something we should just forget about, you know. And he thinks that we can, he sincerely obviously thinks that white people can accomplish their goal without that, just leaving that alone, letting that stand as is. But I think that he might not have the same kind of goals that you and I have. He may accept something less than that, because he talks about, white people have a right to have their own interests and speak up for their own interests. And of course, he wants a white society. He does. But I think he's, I don't know. I just think that people are afraid, the people who do that, who should know better, do it because they don't think it's politically a good idea, politically feasible at all. Go ahead.
It's like even just taking one thing out of that time frame, the Holocaust, even that term, the Holocaust, the implies this is the most important disaster that's ever happened in the world. It's the Holocaust, right? And, you know, you think about that. Who is it supposedly happened to? To Jews. Well, I'm not a Jew. You can ask the typical yokel American, how many Americans died in World War II? They don't have any idea. How many Jews died? Right away, they flip out that 6 million. If that can be undercut alone, just that aspect of that time frame, it can bring down the whole house of cards. Because the Holocaust is something that's only maintained, I mean, it's absurd. It's only maintained because of massive amounts of propaganda and, in many countries, laws that put you in prison. That's pretty easy for even a yokel, if you could reach them. I don't try to reach yokels, but to understand that the truth doesn't need protection from scrutiny. Only legends do.
That's why they passed the laws, because it was
right.
the revisionism was winning out. They didn't have any answers. They couldn't answer, so they passed laws to shut people up. And I think that the Holocaust is the one thing that we should all focus on, because it can be brought down. I believe it can be, if you really know what the revisionists have done. If you're really familiar with the literature, and you don't have to read it all to be familiar with it, but you know, you would know that this Holocaust is so vulnerable. It's kept together by what you said, by the power of the media and the laws. And it's the Jews. It's to the Jews' benefit the most. But it's not only the Jews who. And I don't think all these governments are just totally under the thumb of Jews. Although maybe they are because of the world finances. But these other people think it's in their interest to keep all this Nuremberg version of history intact. It's in their interest to do so. They think so.
But I think their main way is, by they, I mean Jews, for at least being the tipping balance in power, if not the driving force, is their media. Because people are programmed. All they do is, most people, 95% of people, don't have very great abilities when it comes to independent rational thought. They just, through rote memorization, whether it's in school, from the media, some things are just inferred. They're subtle. You're watching something on TV. They don't outright say, this is good, this is bad, but it's inferred by the storyline and what's going on. So they're programmed constantly, and that, I think, is their main thing. None of the other things would be allowed.
Well,
you can talk about the Federal Reserve. You can talk about all the wars for Israel. None of that would be tolerated if it weren't for their control of the media.
Yeah. And, you know, and the media includes Hollywood and books.
All of it.
Newspapers,
magazines.
Everything you take in, they do control it all. It's true.
I include schools.
It's disgusting how they have all these programs in school. You know, when I was in school, there was no such thing. It was never, even the concentration camps or anything were barely mentioned. I don't even know if they were, but they might have been just mentioned, kind of. You know, it just wasn't. It wasn't a deal then. This is
right. I have several, but I have one particular encyclopedia set. It's Funk and Wagnalls from 1959. there's no mention under World War II. If you look for the Holocaust, it's not there. But if you go to National Socialism or World War II or any of the ways you want to search, there's no mention of it. Now, they were pushing it from the beginning, but it didn't fully, there were too many people that just trashed it in high positions. It's not true. But it took them time to get that to really, you know, to get the infrastructure to push such a huge lie. And yes, it's a vulnerable lie. Now, I don't think everyone has to focus on it. I don't think everyone has to be, that's a racialist, let's say, a white racialist, know as much as you do or focus on that. You
well,
know, I still think
I take a different position. I did in a radio show I did, and they don't have to know as much as I do, and I don't know everything, but that's for sure. But they don't have to know everything, and they don't have to read everything. But I do think that if, you know, I think we're too scattered. Although it's, who's going to be the one to say what we should focus on? But I think that if everybody, for the most part, focused on something, on one thing, that could make a difference. We could make more progress in the way we're doing it. So I recommended that everybody focus on the Holocaust and just undo that Holocaust. I think that would be a very good idea. But we're not like people who are all going to follow something, and particularly they're not going to follow me. But don't you think that if we say that is, I really like saying this with you, that this is the one most vulnerable area that they have, that if we could overthrow that, I wonder what kind of a difference it would make, if it would not make as big a difference as we think.
But I think there's all sorts of productive approaches. Somebody can just focus on what's happening right here and now in terms of the anti-white policies, let's say here in America, being flooded with illegal immigration.
Well,
it's getting more.
They can do that, but they can do the Holocaust too. I'm not saying they should give up other things they're doing, but they should add the Holocaust to it, and everybody should be from as many places as possible on Holocaust.
There's a good article. You interviewed him once, Severus Niffelsen, one article called Strength in Division, where he points out that all of these different approaches, there are some people that are just focused, like yourself. Well, you're not just, but you're mainly focused on that time frame. There's other people that are mainly focused on the...
I'm largely focused on that.
Largely on the immigration issues. There's people focused on all different things. And when there's these different groups, or even not groups, what I would refer to as lone wolves, just people out there, let's say propaganda lone wolves, doing whatever they're interested in, the more varied approaches there are, the more varied subjects that are being concentrated on, the more different types of people that can be reached. Some people aren't interested in one thing, but they are in another. And to me, what's important is the end result, some type of racial awakening. And if we can get that to happen, it doesn't, in my mind, have to be a majority of people at all. Just trying to focus on those with the better capabilities for independent rational thought, and that can snowball. You get enough people and it can bring down the whole house of cards. And it's also harder for the system to infiltrate all the different groups, especially if there isn't so many groups or so many people that are just on their own operating. But even with groups or sites or podcasts on all different subjects, it's just harder for them to keep track of everything than having us all focused just on one thing in one organization. That just makes it easy for our enemies, I think.
Well, I already said that I'm not saying that people should focus only on that, but they can add that, and I think more should be said about it. If there was more criticism about Holocaust narrative coming out all the time, I just think it would make a bigger difference, and it would make it more powerful.
Well, like you say, over the last couple decades, they have had to institute all sorts of laws, fining people, putting people in prison for even talking about it. Even attorneys that are just doing their job defending a client, you know, it's illegal to demonstrate that the client told the truth. Truth is not a defense. So some of the people, well, all of them that are very much tied to that time period, let's say like here in America, but also in Britain, France, these old older folks that were veterans, you know, that are very tied to this was a good war. I think things will be better when the last of them, which are happening now, pretty much die off, and you know, younger people aren't as tied to it, or perhaps, I don't know. Actually, the younger people are, each generation is programmed more radically, right? They build lie upon lie, but there could be some potential there, you know, once all of these older guys are gone.
Well, you know, the plight of Holocaust revisionists can be very sad. Vincent Renoir in France, and I wish that more of his work was available in English. I wish, but it's not. It's just, but you can still get a lot out of it. He does a lot of videos, lots and lots of videos, and he's been under attack, and he ran away from France. He had to leave his dear, wonderful wife, and now he's living alone. He says overseas, and he's still working. And he sent out an email just the other day. And he said he didn't think he could continue. And then I guess he got a whole lot of responses. And next thing, 2 days later, he put out another video saying that he was going to continue because of all the response that he got. Suppose some people sent him some more money. But, you know, he lives entirely on donations, and he's a wanted man, and he does wonderful, wonderful work. And he's a National Socialist. I just love him. I just think the world of him. But you mentioned Niflson, Severus Niflson, Bill, and I wanted to say to you that I heard you mention him on your interview with Tan Stoffel, and I had Severus on 3 times, not just once.
Oh.
And I always enjoyed him, but Tan Stoffel really hated him, and I found it interesting that when you talked about him quite a bit, Tan just stayed silent. He didn't say, but when I had my program, he wrote some real angry type of comments.
I like every one of his articles that I read, and I read them all. And he disappeared several months ago, maybe as many as 6 now. I lose track.
Yeah.
But I've got a section on the site there you'll see on the front page there with his old image there. And it says, Niflson's Mind. I've taken all the articles that I had. I don't think I have them all. I might be missing one. And I have them here on the site. So I thought they were very, very good. And he would bring up some interesting ways of looking at things. Anyway, I got off track there.
Yeah. Well, I could tell you really liked him. And the article that he did that I did interviewed him about was Are White Males Hooked on Weakness?
Yeah, that was a good one.
Stoffel really didn't like that. He hates anything when you give any criticism at all of whites that anything might be their fault.
Well, that was an excellent article. Yeah, and that's the one I heard. That I didn't know you interviewed him 3 times. I'll have to look through your site there and find those.
Yeah.
Because I'll add them to my stream. Anytime he's been interviewed, I've liked it. Anyway, is there anything you want to say about the IHR, that Institute for Historical Review, and how it's, I think, been ruined over the last several years?
Well, that's the thing to say about it. It's been ruined. And it was quite a while back that it happened. And, you know, when you have these disputes, and some people say that the Jews were infiltrated in there, one or two, and they were the ones who managed to create all that. But others say no, that it was, they blame it on Willis Carto, and it, you know, everybody takes their side, you know, whatever side they're on there. But it's all about money. You know, there was money. There's a lot of money was left to the IHR, and when it came time to get it, the revisionists there decided that that they weren't getting the money, that Willis Carto was going to put it in different areas of his of all the things that he owned, and I called it an empire, and Michael Collins Piper got mad at me for calling it an empire. Well, he doesn't have an empire. Willis Carto's basically a good person, but everybody has enemies, and those who don't like them, and he developed a lot of enemies amongst the revisionists who thought that I don't know they had all. Well, what they were trying to prevent is what actually they ended up with by letting Mark Weber become editor and then become director, and then he just took control of the whole thing. He had he got a board of directors that would do what he wanted. And then he stopped doing everything. He stopped doing the journal. He stopped everything, and now he just has that little that little mailing he puts out. And he's got a cushy place there. He doesn't even have to work. He just goes there, and people continue to send donations and money there because it's a nice website, you know. Not that he's put anything new on there, but, you know, it has all that old stuff there, and people use it. So, and also he's a 5031 or whatever that is. So what he's looking for is a lot of these people who are friendly to revisionism, as they get old and they die, then they're going to leave a good amount of money, good amount of their money to the IHR. Well, people are looking. People like that are looking for good places to leave their money. They are, who are, you know, pro-white or racialist or revisionist or whatever. And unfortunately, if they want it to be tax deductible, they have you have to have a 501(c)(3), and that's a kind of a pain in the neck, you know. Countercurrents got one. What's his name?
I can't either.
All of a sudden, now that I'm trying to think of it, I can't think of it. But you know, this is why they get it, because there are a lot of people who want to donate fairly good sums, but they want it to be tax deductible. So there's lots of ways that we're just not really cashing in here, you know.
Well, my problem with Weber is, in addition to what you mentioned, you know, I can look on YouTube. I saved a couple of the older videos that he did. He's changed his tune, okay? He now, not just now, for years now, at least a couple, has been saying that there was 2 million Jews gassed. That wasn't his old tune, you know.
No.
That's the tune now, so now even the Jews can say, oh, even over at that IHR, that evil anti-Semite site, even they acknowledge 2 million, when, of course, it was really 60 gazillion. But I,
you know, the revisionists had come to a conclusion, and everybody agreed that there were no gassings, and there is no evidence whatsoever for any extermination camps with gas, you know, homicidal human gas chambers. And yet, David Irving started that.
Right.
After he was spent some time in prison in Australia, so who knows what his motivation is. It might be just that he wants to remain viable, and he wants his books to continue to be sold, or I don't know if they are sold. But in any case, Weber just follows David Irving.
I don't believe he's sincere, though, because in that video he listed many of the things we all know about the impossibility of the gassing stories, okay? It couldn't have happened that way. There's so much evidence to demonstrate.
In the early one?
Right. So he used to bring up these issues, you know, varying from how many bodies, how long it would take in the ovens. What about the amount of wood piles that would be out there? What about the ash? You know, you could go on for hours of all the different things that demonstrate it couldn't have happened. And yet, he pointed out many of those things in videos I've seen where he's being interviewed and the video is just playing the audio and showing some pictures. In any case, I called in when he was on one of these podcasts at Renegade and asked him what new information is there to dispute all these things he used to believe. And he had nothing. All he's talking about is some document. You know, so what? How does that dispute any of the things you used to say, which demonstrated the whole idea is impossible, can't happen? Now suddenly there's some document about something in the East, and now you're just going to go with it? And it mentions nothing in this document?
Well, that document's been known for a long time. That's the, I can't think of the name. The Hoefele telegram and then this document has a name too. The documents,
right.
They both say the same thing.
And you talked about it. It doesn't mention anything about gassing.
No,
you know the German, right?
You know, it's been explained, and I have something on my site about it that
right. The
whole thing explains it all and so on. He's horrible, this weasel Weber. You know, he's just horrible. I mean, I don't know how people can be so disgusting. I just don't get it. You know, he knew he hobnobbed around with all the good revisionists. they treated him very well. He did good work while he was with them, and then he just decided that he didn't want to work anymore. And he found a way to keep running that organization without having to work anymore or write anything. And this is one thing that made me angry at Voice of Reason, that Mike Connor was telling me that he has been talking with Mark Weber, and he was going to have Mark Weber start doing a show again. You know, Mark Weber did one for a while, and then he quit because he can't keep working. He's so lazy. And Mark was going to start again. I said, I'm really against that. You know, it really upsets me that you're going to have Mark Weber on here. Well, I think he'll bring value to the network. Well, there's no doubt he brought value to the network. But that, there you go. You see, what are there any principles? Are people living by any principles or not? They talk about one thing and they behave differently.
Well, so. I don't think the guy is sincere. I don't think he's on our side. And if he is on our side, we don't need people like that on our side. Let's see. Yeah, here in the chat, I see a ways up there. Urban said she's one of the, well, we haven't been doing regular podcasts lately, but she's one of the hosts here. She said she wanted to hear your take on Christianity. We're going to ask that shortly, or I'm going to ask. But she said, so glad to hear that she is a racialist. Urban, you must not have checked her out too much. I think you said tonight that you would call yourself a racialist, but even if I've never heard you use that, I just figured you were, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe you would just say pro-white, but it was pretty damn clear to me.
Yeah, well, why? I didn't know. Is that a term now that you're supposed to use if to make people understand it? No, I
call myself a racialist, mm-hmm. right? But I'm fine with somebody just saying pro-white, or I don't care if they say white nationalist, whatever. But, you know, it's clear to me that you're pro-white. I mean, that network before was called the White Network, right?
That's right. That's why I came up with that, because I was so discouraged at the Voice of Reason that they had all this non-white stuff going on and more to come. And so I was thinking, boy, I think I should find a way to start another network, the White Network. You know, it was just as a kind of a reaction to people who were doing things where they allowed non-whiteness to come in. So the idea was that it was only going to have white people on it. There weren't going to be any non-white people on the network. But that's as far as the white part went. Well, I was going to say that later on, but, you know, it wasn't about white nationalism per se. It wasn't against white nationalism, but it wasn't set up as a white nationalist network. In the about thing, the mission statement that Tan Stoffel has made so much about, it doesn't say, it says white any number of times, but nowhere does it say white nationalist or white nationalism. So.
I told you how I look at nationalism. So
yeah.
I would call you one even if you didn't. I'm saying in my mind, I would think of
that.
You as being one,
yeah,
as long as you look at
that. But I also feel like I have the right to be critical of white nationalism and white nationalists, as you yourself have been.
Oh yeah, I'm
you know,
critical on a regular basis.
Yeah.
So
a lot of people are.
I don't think we should just always stroke ourselves and pretend as if it's all the Jews' fault, as if we play no role in this, our people as a whole, because I'm about natural law. And in the big picture, long-term, natural law sense, if we go down, there will be nobody to blame but ourselves. All right?
It has to be that way. You know, in spiritual law, whatever you come upon is your own creation. I mean, what you meet up with is what you've created one way or another.
Or at least
so,
how you deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah, so you have to face up to that. And there's no way that the white race cannot overcome the Jew if we were united about it and really wanted to do it.
Anything, if you look at throughout history, you know, that moved the wheels of history, that had a big influence, didn't involve majorities. It involved tiny little dedicated ruthless minorities who were able to then later manipulate the majorities. So what I'm getting at, we have to have enough people within our race that are going to face reality. And that means looking at the problems within our people. You know, there's that debate between white genocide versus racial suicide. Now, clearly, you know, UN definitions and, you know, there's a genocide agenda. I get that. And not everyone's going along with it. And, of course, there's been resistance throughout the years, various types of resistance. But in the big picture natural law sense, if the resistance is not enough to defeat the agenda, and many of our people are being programmed or propagandized to go along, let's say symbolically on the path to racial suicide, all right? So it's true there's an element out there that has a genocidal agenda, but if they're talking us into it, since we have the capability of surviving and of prospering and dominating, if enough of us choose to do whatever the hell it takes to make that happen, if we go down, then in my book, it's racial suicide, big picture, okay? And a lot of people, they don't want to hear that. It's all the Jews, or the Jews lie. The Jews cheat. They're not playing fair. No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt that Jews behave parasitically and that Jews are a difficult enemy. They've got some strengths that we're not able to deal with very well. But still, the thing is, we have to learn to do it. We have to do it. Go ahead.
Here's somebody in the chat here. How many here are committing suicide? I said big picture, right? In a natural law sense, I'm not. Carolyn Yeager's not. Maybe you're not. And there's other whites in the struggle that aren't. But if our race goes down, it will be collectively racial suicide, since there is no reason we should have to go down. All right?
Right. And
as I said,
they're not purposely saying, I'm going to commit suicide. They just don't get it, you know. And
they're being talked into a path that leads to racial suicide. And if they go along with it, there's enough information out there that even the yokels, even the lemmings, are aware of some of it, okay, especially with the Internet. But even how blatantly anti-white the media has become, I mean, they're becoming so extreme about it. It's out there. I run across it with lemmings that are getting fed up. So there's enough information out there so that people know what's going on when they go along with the homosexual agenda. Don't tell me, I don't care how much propaganda you've been exposed to, that you don't know instinctively that you don't let faggots adopt little boys. All right? So when our people go along with this kind of trash, yeah, I look at it as big picture racial suicide. But it's not over yet, so.
No, it's not over yet. I know you don't like Trump. But he's saying things that are bringing things into the debate here that we would never have expected, and yet it's happening. And I don't think it's orchestrated from above. I'm not saying he's everything we would want, and I can understand why you're very suspicious. But I think he's bringing things in that it's great, you know, that we're able to. And it also it's showing that a lot of white people are supporting what he's saying. They're able to support him when they're not able to support someone who would be identified like David Duke as a white nationalist.
But they would support any candidate who was saying some of the same things and put out that kind of presence, the masculine thing where he's, you know, that
yeah.
People will say that, oh, he doesn't take any shit, you know, he really
yeah.
fires back. Okay, they would support anyone who does something like that. It doesn't have to be Trump. But I see it as a negative because it's just like the conservatives, to me, are far more dangerous than the liberals because they catch more white people in their net, okay? Anybody who's attracted to liberal propaganda is rotten to the core, okay? But the conservative propaganda lies a bit and presents it and has some good elements to it so that it can trick more of our people. And that's what I see Trump is doing, okay? He'll be able to get whites that might otherwise be on the, you know, right on the edge of maybe becoming racially aware or becoming more racial. He'll be able to, he's like a pressure relief valve. He'll be able to get them to think, hey, somebody cares about us. Somebody's looking out for our interests. Somebody's going to do something about the border. And, of course, nothing's going to change. He's a snake. And so that's why I see him as a problem because he's going to catch.
If he got elected, he might do something about the border.
No, he wouldn't. The border, he talks about a wall. A wall is just nonsense, okay? We have a power structure that wants.
He talks about laws, too, you know.
Right.
I mean, but he's just talking about the wall.
We have a power structure that wants the invasion, okay? when that changes, you don't need a damn wall. If you had a wall now, they would just go under it or over it. You have to have the commitment to stop them, which doesn't require a wall. You can put boots on the ground overnight. 10 or 20,000 would secure the entire border. Plus, you can have drones, cameras. You don't even need that many people.
Well, I think
that's not going to change. He's not going to do anything about that.
Well, he's talking about the 14th Amendment. See, that's just bringing that up and having it now out there in a serious way, like it can be seriously considered. I think you can't ever put it back to where we can't even talk about something like that. Oh, that's in the Constitution. Well, I think he's made a big move there, which I think is very good. We're not going to find Adolf Hitler coming.
Oh, I'm saying when it comes to the masses, his influence will be very negative. I'm saying if he were to win, okay, and become president, he would be able to get more and more whites whose frustration with the system is growing. He would be able to turn that into patriotism and pride again, even though we would stay on the same damn white genocide.
I understand that.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway,
I'm getting way off. I did a podcast on that. If you listen, you'll get my...
I did listen to it. I don't think I was able to finish it, though, but
okay.
I listened to most of it.
All right. Anyway, I wanted to ask you another question here.
Yeah.
There are folks that put forth absurd arguments in order to promote the idea that Hitler and the National Socialists were not really racial, not really even anti-Jew. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yeah.
In particular?
Yeah,
what's her name?
About, you mean you want me to be talking about Veronica K. Clark?
Yeah, I can't stand that freak. She calls herself a asexual supremacist. one of the videos she did, she referred to herself as doing research about that second book by Hitler, and all she did was read a Wiki article, and she called that research.
Yeah, she's a fake. I can say that. I believe it. People are really fooled into thinking that she's a real scholar. I understood when she was on Deanna Spingola's show, sometimes she controlled those programs she did with Deanna Spingola, and so she determined what she wanted to say. And she would be all prepared for it, and she'd say, so then Deanna would say, well, what's next? She'd say, well, we're going to talk about blah, blah, Veronica would. And then she'd say, well, in such and such book, you know, it says this, blah, blah, blah. And she'd quote from the book, and she'd talk about it a little bit. And people thought, oh, wow, she's such a scholar. She reads all these books. She quotes from all these books. And she just takes part of it, takes something from it, and fools people. And the books that she writes are full of nothing, you know, that she's translated and somebody else has translated from people, stories that people have told and are telling. And one of her latest books is on the Gleiwitz affair, and that's an old story. She doesn't have anything new in there. That's all known. You can say, well, she's maybe making it better known by writing this book if people like her books. So I have nothing against that. But she really gets nasty now about Hitler and the last thing I read by her, she was standing up for Poland. She's been doing that lately against Hitler's terrible attitude toward the Poles and so on. But, you know, as far as racialism, Hitler was very clear and he over and over again about his racial beliefs and that he thought Jews were very bad for Germany and they couldn't coexist and so on. And he expressed this in a long speech which had the title of Why We Are Anti-Semitic or Why We Are Anti-Semites. His party in, I think it was in 1921 that he gave that speech in the Hofbrauhaus. Very long speech, and I have it translated into English on my website. You can find it by looking under Führer speeches, a new category I have under the German Reich on the right sidebar. And all the way to his last will and testament in April 1945, he repeated again about the Jews and race and keeping the race pure. And he never wavered on this. So people like Veronica Clark just infer things. They find something somewhere, you know, that he said or that he did, and they infer that he means he was changing
right.
his mind about race. Go ahead.
Well, I consider it especially destructive because she's trying to play with the Jewish narrative as if there's something wrong with being opposed to Jews. Anybody in their right mind should be opposed to Jews. And I don't mean just whites. Anybody, all right? So she's trying to find some way to say, well, he wasn't really an anti-Semite or anti-Jewish, as if that's something bad, you know. He was a good guy, right?
Well, she wants to say he wasn't anti-Negro. And, you know, she was on John Friend's program, and a radio program that John Friend put on. And I just don't know why John Friend, you know, I've kind of made up with him, and he is a very nice guy. I don't think he's too effective, but I shouldn't be putting him down. He's effective with a lot of people. He's young. He's got a long way to go. But he puts on Veronica Clark. He should know better than to do that. And he lets her spout off all her stuff. And she is trying to say that Negroes were welcome in Germany, and they could even be part of the gene pool. There was no problem. It's just stupid, you know. It's just nonsense. He did say when she said that, he said, oh, I don't know about that. And then they got old Fritz Berg on. He's there, too, and I don't remember how that went, but they were both there, and Fritz is agreeing with her. That's so wrong of him. I don't know. These people don't want to be racial. They say, I'm not a racist. I'm not a racist.
Now, I don't expect the masses to be on board with anything until, you know, their propaganda
changes.
Well,
they follow the leader. You know, they follow the...
But within the struggle, you know, we're not going to get anywhere if we can't even face that, if we can't defend racism or racialism, if we're going to be shitting and pissing our pants every time somebody says racist, you know. That's very, very cowardly, very weak. It's understandable for the masses, but I have zero tolerance for it within the struggle.
Well,
although I guess there can be, you know, some people that concentrate in different avenues that are trying to reach the masses, that along the edges that can have some effect. It's not like you're going to, they can't awaken while their media is in enemy hands, but there can be, you know, slight movement, at least maybe so they're not as hostile. Certain memes might be able to catch on and get into their subconscious if they run across them enough. But anyway, when it comes to Clark, she's one of only three people that I ever, there's plenty of people I don't trust and that I think are a big problem, but there's only three that are so toxic that I will, you know, publicly talk about them, and she's one of them, so.
Oh, and a lot of white nationalists really liked her and thought she was doing great and supported her until she turned against white nationalists, and then they realized. And you know, she came on to the comment board on a couple of my programs that I did on the White Network, and I learned a lot about her, which I was confused about because I read a lot of things about her. I didn't know if they were true or not, but she verified all this crazy stuff about herself, and she said that she was a paleo-liberal, and she belonged to some kind of paleo-liberal organization thing. She recommended me to go read about it, which I did, and it's kind of like a super-libertarian. So if she's a super-libertarian, she's sure not a national socialist. She has no sympathy with it, but she's writing about it and putting herself up as an expert on it, and people are going along with that.
Right.
Oh, it's kind of sickening.
I think she's a problem.
Yeah.
Some people
want to say that, you know, I'm on my phone here. It's a new phone, pretty new, but I don't know how long the battery's going to last. So we should, I suppose, I want to get the last question. So.
Well, let me just do the Christian one first. I don't think you are a Christian, but how would you describe yourself, let's say, religiously or spiritually?
Yeah, I'm not very religious. I consider myself spiritual. I have had a lot of practice and experience and time spent in what you call spiritual discovery and so on. So, and I've looked into a whole lot of spiritual movements or truths, paths, I guess you should say. I don't do any of that now. I just focus on history and revisionism and so on. I don't like to talk against Christianity. I have too many Christian friends, too many good people. I know they're good people, and they're very good to me. Sometimes Christians are really good people. They're not going to do you wrong at all. And, of course, there's a lot of non-Christians that are that way, too. So, but I'm not a Christian. I don't believe in the dogma. I don't really believe in the Bible. But I would consider myself kind of a nominal Christian in the sense of a civilizational Christian or something, which I know you don't, but in the same sense, actually, that I think Hitler did. Now, Hitler was not a believer. After reading Table Talk, there's a lot better understanding for me of him there. I was really glad to hear what he had to say. And he was not a believer. Even so, he didn't want to tear the social cohesion that Christianity contributed to Germany and to Europe at that time, and it would have been really difficult then. And I would say that if the United States were a real Christian nation now, we wouldn't be having this same-sex marriage and same-sex adoption and so on.
Well, I think that because of Christian moral codes that we're facing just about every serious problem we have, including the homosexual agenda, because we don't want to hate the sinner. We must love the sinner and forgive the sinner, but we can hate the sin, in this case, homosexuality. But, hey, we're all God's children. So you earlier mentioned communism. Well, I look at Christianity as the first communism or Marxism, universalism, egalitarianism.
Hitler liked Christianity to communism.
But anyway, I understand your take on it. I'm very different. I don't think at core somebody can be very good if they're a Christian. And there's a religious Christianity and secular, because the moral codes that we get from the movies, from sitcoms, from even commercials, from articles, from the newspapers, magazines, is based on Christianity. The ideas of who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, why are they good, why are they bad, it's all based.
There are Christians who are anti-Jewish.
Yeah, I know. But they can never really fight the Jews because they believe in the end, if we sprinkle some holy water on them, they're our brothers in Christ.
Well, there's an awful lot.
In fact, isn't it
a
brotherhood of man?
That's not just Christians. Look at all the kind of people who Kevin MacDonald has, and more so Jared Taylor and so on. They're very friendly to Jews if they're not anti-white Jews.
Right. When I talk about Christian moral codes, there's lefties that say they hate Christianity. Let's talk about the typical leftist of today who says he hates Christianity. He's more Christianized than a person who called himself a Christian 100 years ago and went to church every Sunday. What I'm trying to get at is the moral codes are the same for the lefties, for the people on the right, for the people in the middle, for our entire societies, because the Jews push those Christian moral codes.
Well, the people are Christian because it's traditional and they've been brought up that way, or they've chosen it at some point in their life.
What is the main thing of Christianity? A brotherhood of man. What is the main?
Well, I don't think most people even think about all that stuff. It's just they think.
No, it's subconscious.
Natural.
It's so deep within them, the programming since they're little. Everybody, we've got to be fair to everyone.
Yeah, but you think that you're going to get. You think that what people should think is to love their racial brethren and hate everybody else?
Anybody who's a threat, right.
Yeah, if they don't see them as a threat, that's the thing. I think if they saw them as a threat, they would not be so sanguine about it, but they don't see them as a threat.
Because they're brought up, instead of with natural law moral codes, they're brought up with Christian moral codes, whether they're atheists, and they got it from the YouTube from lefty shows.
I think it's all the same. I think it's just white people moral codes. I think it's in our.
No, you just have to look into the pre-Christian religions, and they were based on natural law, and they were white religions. Okay, so
I don't know. I pretty much believe in reincarnation. Nothing has shaken that for me since I started to believe in it a long time ago. It remains the only sensible thing.
Is there anything you would like to say in response to what Tan Stoffel said about you when I interviewed him?
Yes, and thank you very much. Let me first say that I have no desire to be enemies with Tan Stoffel, but he forced me to be when he, on April 15th, 2014, commandeered our network, shut me out and shut it down for very flimsy reasons that don't hold up in an honest inquiry. I have written this out, Bill, because I wanted
sure.
to keep within a certain time period. So I'm just going to read what I've got
sure.
in order to get through it. And when he goes on radio programs like yours, he continues to attack and characterize me in unflattering ways, which for the most part are not true. done that on other programs, too, and people will say, well, he didn't say all bad things. He said some good things. But the good things are just what everybody knows, and the bad things are not true. So, and so I want to set the record straight on a few things, because that's all I have time for. Okay, the excuse that Tan Staffel used in his last, the White Network program, that he titled My Mistake, the reason that he gave for shutting down the network at that point was, Carolyn Yeager has used this platform, which I had provided for her, to attack and denigrate white nationalism and, by extension, whites as a race. Well, you know, when I heard him say that and I saw it written when he did the program, which I was listening to, I was just so shocked that I thought, well, so he can say bad things about me. I can take it. You know, that's all right. I had no idea that he was going to shut down the network. But going back and looking at this particular program post here where he says this, the evidence that he gave for this, that I had attacked and denigrated whites, was my previous radio program of Saturday, April 12th, and my comments on two recent Table Talk episodes, number 5 and number 6, on April 3rd and April 10th. So that covers a period of about 12 days, maybe 13 days. And yet, in the 30 comments for that program, which had from Saturday to the following Tuesday, which then everything closed down, no one protested that I was attacking or denigrating white nationalism or whites as a race. See, it's only Tan Staffel who took offense at all this stuff. And everything that he says about me, it's mostly him that took offense at it and thought it was so serious, not anybody else. And there were people who kind of got on his side afterwards, but they wouldn't have been bothered by it on their own. And this comment to that program that he took so much offense to, he wrote a comment himself. This is on April 14th last year, and he said, Carolyn has called for comment, and I'd like the White Network listeners to know that I do indeed intend to comment at length in my next program. So that sounds rather threatening, but I was prepared for some heavy criticism from him in his program, and I thought that I could handle that, but I didn't expect anything like what he did, which absolutely stunned me. Which he does try to say that I expected it or that he had talked about it. He didn't talk about anything like that. So he says, in the program with you, he said, we did a good job for 2 years, meaning he and I, but in the end it was a mismatch and there was some stress. He says, and I really didn't like that when she at the very end ended up quoting Jews. And here he sounds unsure of himself because he's talking real slow. Anti-white Jews, maybe he's thinking that his wife is part Jewish, and he quotes her, so he had to say anti-white Jews. Can't think of the fellow's name, Zeskin, Leonard Zeskin, quoted, you know, just read verbatim from Wikipedia what he had to say about white nationalism. And I thought, this is odd. I don't want to deal with this. So I put the network on. I just froze it, and I said it was going to be read-only from here on. I want a divorce, basically. And I didn't want to be involved with her anymore. I didn't want to work with her anymore. End of story. So from this, you know, he wants us to believe that though everything was good for 2 years, this one program of mine caused him to make the sudden decision to pull down the network. I think that's not likely. And I want to explain that he told me maybe 2 weeks to a month before this, that he had been spending time at Majority Rights Forum and recommended it to me. He seemed to be saying that he thought I would get on a better track, the same track he was on, maybe, if I would hang out at Majority Rights. And he even said that I should go there. Well, I told him I was familiar with it from way back, and I looked at it once in a while still, but I didn't find it very interesting. He just accepted that, didn't say anything. But that was before Daniel Sienwickiewicz, I don't know how to pronounce his name. He calls himself Daniel S. He's half Polish and half Italian, he says. But he was put in charge of that site. And after Tan Staffel did a radio interview with them shortly after he stole the White Network, I realized that he had been talking a lot with Daniel S., and that is where the rejection of Table Talk came from, because he was telling me that Table Talk was a problem, too. This was after he did what he did. So it was Danny Boy and Tanny Boy getting all buddy-buddy there, and Tan Staffel never denied this, but Daniel did. He denied it over and over again, but that's what makes me think it's true. And It was funny that after I did a radio program discussing the Tan-Dan relationship, Daniel wrote several comments at Tan's blog making a lot of noise about it, but Tan would not even reply to them. Tan was avoiding Daniel S. at that time. So Tan Staffel then went on to say, this is what's showing that he had decided to end his relationship with the White Network, but he didn't know how to do it. But he goes on to say, for the 2 years, it was basically like a master's degree for me in race and Jews, because the regular schedule every week compelled me to sit down and study things. It was like a college course, a degree. I enjoyed that part, and when I realized I could keep doing this on my own, then you broke in to change the subject. And that was the last bit about that. But to me, all of this, that he is saying that he wanted out, he didn't like what I said, and so on, this tells clearly that he decided a while before that program on April 12th that he was going to do something about getting out. And he used that program as a pretext for shutting down the White Network. It's just a pretext. He had been in conversation, as I said, with people at Majority Rights, and he had gotten convinced that he wanted to change company. He didn't want to be involved with Carolyn Yeager anymore. So what I'm getting at is that I think that's cowardly. What he did at the White Network was cowardly. He didn't have what it took to tell me face-to-face that he didn't want to continue with me and allow us to work something out. And because of the way that he acted by using his technical control to put himself totally in charge, there's still this well of bitterness about the whole thing. It's in him and it's in me, even a year later. And neither one of us can make peace with it. I have a thing that I want to suggest. I'm making an offer. First, I have to say something else that I had told him that I didn't give him permission to include my programs on his archive page. He then took everything down, and he had everything redacted. But since then, I noticed just last week when I went there to check on some things that he has my audio program back up there, and they're available on players on the White Network archive site. Now, I wouldn't mind having my shows, text and all, on his archive site if he didn't have all the stuff he added on there after saying he was going to freeze the site just as it was. But he didn't do that. First, he added a short blog called The End, in which he admitted that I decided without consulting or seeking Carolyn Yeager's consent that the White Network will no longer be used to record or broadcast any new programs. There will be no further posts or comments. Wow, you know, big decision. That's what did it for me when I made my decisions for what I should do. But there would be no further posts or comments except for him, because he then added a long ongoing blog post titled Why This Archive, in which he explains himself over and over and over again. Now, I'm making an offer to Tan that I don't mind his restoring all of my material to his archive site, my intellectual property, which he really has no right to use without my permission, if he removes the additional posts he added after his last podcast. Not that I don't realize that they make him look bad, but it is an anti-Carolyn introduction to the site for anyone who goes there, because those are the things that are in the right there, the first thing that you see. I think that's an unseemly thing to be doing. I think the whole thing is unseemly, what he's done. So if he does not do what I ask, I'm prepared to copyright all my programs and take legal action against him for stealing them from my website. And additionally, I will put up a page using my domain name of thewhitenetwork.com. I do own that domain. I always did. And tell the true story of Mr. Tan Staffel and the White Network in a better and more complete way than I've done before. So I'm not trying to make threats here, but I wanted to make this offer for a way to kind of bring this White Network thing to a better ending than what it has come to. And so I thank you for the opportunity to say those things, Bill.
Now, Tan, he did say that he likes the work that was done for those 2 years, so maybe, you know, it would make sense if he likes that work to be able to put it all back up there and just take out all that explanation as to why you parted, you know. I thought it would
have been better. Yeah, because it's all in his words. Yeah, I wasn't allowed to ever post anything there after that.
Well, what about if he had the condition then that you would take down your podcast where you respond to his, and then the whole thing just goes away, and the White Network is up there just with the old stuff, anybody knew would have no idea what happened other than it was, you know, ended.
Well, that's something I would consider. The thing is, if he's going to put up the white network and say this is an archive, as it was as of April 15th, 2014, then that's what it should be. It shouldn't have extra stuff ahead of that for people to read where he goes on and on and on. Now, true, he got stuff from me there too, but I didn't select it. I didn't get to say what I wanted to have there. He selected it.
Right.
And he says an awful lot. I mean, it's just awful. It actually makes him look very bad, in my opinion. So in one way, I don't really care. If he doesn't want to do anything about it, then let him leave it there. I think it harms him. He sees what he did at the White Network to be very, very important to him. And, of course, 2 years of my work is there, so it's important to me, too. And I think it's just wrong to degrade me that way, even if people don't believe it. A lot of people don't know, like you say, so they come along and they see that and they say, gee, you know, they see my name and they'll tend to believe what he said because it's written there.
Well, so if he likes the work, it might make sense for him not to indirectly disparage it by disparaging you. So maybe he'll go along with that if you do the same and take down your stuff. Now, most people, I understand you're involved, he's involved, so it's important to you too, but most people don't care about these kind of things.
No, I agree. You know, so I question that, but it bothers me. And just like you said, when he was talking to you, he's remembering. She said this. Boy, it irked me. You know, and I thought it sounded like feminism. Well, he presents things in a certain way that is his way, but I didn't see it that way. And I'm not a feminist, and I don't like being called a feminist. I think it's wrong, and I think white nationalist men have gone overboard in their fear and reaction against feminism, because ordinary women wanting to have some say over their lives is not feminism. Feminism is a Jewish thing to disrupt and destroy gender relationships and male-female gender realities. You know, I mean, the authentic male-female gender, and to put women on top of men in the marketplace and things like that.
There are natural gender roles. They're general, okay? There's overlap, but there are, in terms of natural law, there are complementary, but different.
People fall naturally into it. And the people who don't fall into it as clear-cut, well, there have always been people like that in our societies. There's always been men and there's always been women who don't quite fit the typical role of their gender, but they do things. Look at what about Hannah Reich? Hannah Reich was a great hero in Germany. Everybody loves Hannah Reich. All she ever wanted to do was fly a plane. She didn't dream about having children or babies, and she never married and she never had children. And nobody faults her for it. They had plenty of women in Germany at that time having babies.
Well, that's where the difference is, though. Well, you need to look at things when you're making policy, let's say leadership, designing policies to benefit the people that they represent. You've got to look at things generally, okay? In other words, you're pushing a general trend, let's say, in terms of women taking care of children, getting married, and men going out and work. And I'm fine with employers. We live in a country where, we're told that we don't have the right to hire who we want. There has to be certain laws that apply. I can't discriminate, which means choose who I want to hire. So if an employer decides, like they used to, 50, 100 years ago, that I'm going to hire this man over this woman because he's a provider for a family. Way back, women used to get part-time jobs when there was extra money needed for Christmas or something. These are general things, so you push things in a way so that generally it's best for your society. That doesn't mean that there's not going to be some women who don't have children, some women that become scientists, you know what I'm saying? You don't have to have it so rigid.
No, and even nature is not so rigid, because there's oddballs in nature, too, that they don't quite fit in sometimes, and they're tolerated. Well, there's all kinds of stories about the flora and the fauna and how this works out, but, this is the way life is. It's the way natural life is. Everything is not cut like in a machine in a factory.
All right.
If I'm a fan of National Socialist Germany, and I think whatever took place there was just great, then I'm not a feminist.
Right.
I don't like being called that just because this or that thing. Let me just point out one little thing here, which is kind of interesting. It'll only take a second. You know, Tan mentioned during his talk with you that one thing that bothered him was I used the phrase, as a woman, I think such and such. I really didn't use that very much. I remember one time saying that, and I probably said it more than one time. But he called that feminism. Well, I want to point out that just yesterday, I was looking at the Daily Stormer, and Andrew Anglin had a new article there, and he started it out by saying, as a man, there are certain behavioral decisions that your biology makes for you, blah, blah, blah. So he says, as a man, nobody's, I'm sure Tan Stoffel will never criticize Andrew Anglin. He doesn't criticize anybody, it seems. He doesn't want to make enemies. But Andrew Anglin can say, as a man. But why can't I say, as a woman? Because sometimes you have a woman's point of view on something.
And sometimes there are specific instances where a man could say, as a man, and it comes off all right. But generally, it is kind of strange to hear a man say, as a man. But there are times, you know, let's say they're talking about sex or gender role. Well, then they'll say, well, as a man. But anyway, I expect to hear that more from women. I just consider that normal. Even in today's society where feminism is pushed a lot, at core, subconsciously, most women haven't accepted it. I think men have actually accepted it more because it's an excuse for them to discard their responsibilities. But women, at core, they still look for strength, no matter what they say, a man to kind of be the head of the family, to lead, to advise, you know, that kind of thing. So maybe you won't like this, but in a way it is, in some respects, a man's world. So that's why women might say, as a woman. So I didn't see that as any kind of big deal. But then with Anglin, a lot of what he says when he's went on this feminist thing, I actually agree with, and some of it that I agree with, you probably wouldn't. But then he moves beyond that to throw in things that aren't true, and he neglects bringing up things that are a matter of degree, like when he talks about men being more rational. Well, I believe that's generally true. And lemminghood, let's say, for example, wanting to go along with what's popular, what's fashionable, women are more prone to that. But it's a matter of degree. And he'll talk about men being more rational, and then he'll go on to talk about Adam and Eve as the first feminism, the first original sin. Well, you certainly don't come off as being very rational to me when you're going to base your arguments on a fairy tale. And that whole story, he says in there that Eve ate the apple. And so he's blaming her for the original sin. But wait a minute. Adam ate it too, but he mentions in there, but she talked him into it. So Adam has the excuse that Eve talked her into it. He's not a man. He's just, she talked me into it. Eve doesn't have the excuse that a talking snake talked her into it. If a snake starts talking, I'm more apt to pay attention, you know, because they don't talk. He's funny. You know, and I'm very much pro patriarchy, and many people misunderstand that because of the way the Bible had it, which is very hostile toward women. But just generally, male leadership is what that means.
Well, I like the term, Bill, male leadership. I don't like the term patriarchy, because patriarchy, you can say it has a lot of different meanings, but it basically means that women are men's property, because in the old patriarchy, women had no rights. And Andrew Anglin has said he wants to go back to that. Of course, he's not in charge of anything, but he says we should go back to that, where women shouldn't have any rights, because we need to tell them what to do, because we don't want them speaking up to us or standing up to us or speaking when we're speaking, or, you know, thinking that they're as equal to us and so on. And this is just...
We're not equal. Nobody's equal. That means the same. People,
yeah, but there's
confused.
A lot of women. You know, there's such a thing as IQ, Bill, and which you know. And IQ, there's a whole lot of women who have higher IQs than a whole lot of men. So that's a biblical thing, saying this: women belong here and men belong here. The Third Reich did it right. They did it right. They had their position, but they allowed exceptions to take place without making a big deal about it. And everybody was basically felt that things were being done in a fair way. But this is amongst German people. And again, I say, you know, I consider ethnicity as well as race, which is another thing that Tanstoffel had a lot of problem with me at the end there, because he was listening to Daniel S. And that's what I say. He himself has said that Western Europeans are smarter, or whatever you want to say, do better than Eastern Europeans. But Eastern Europeans are still white, and it's okay if he mentions it, but he doesn't want to hear me say anything about it, or maybe he doesn't want to hear Adolf Hitler say anything about it. But the fact is that people are on different levels, even as ethnicities. And so if you take a German women might be a whole lot more capable than and more intelligent than the men of Albania.
You'd have to do the IQ test, and first off,
well, they've done them.
But if you know what the IQ tests are based on now, it's the Stanford Binet test, which was designed specifically by that individual, last name Binet, to gender norm the tests. And they did that by including questions that aren't indicative of intelligence. A lot of people confuse intelligence.
Well, I don't know. There's some very I don't know, you know, and I can't. I'm not in a position to argue this at all. But I know that there's some very people that have a lot of respect, you know, white people who have a lot of respect by all the white community who are experts in all this IQ business, like that Charles somebody who've done all this work, and they don't say that IQ tests don't mean anything.
I'm not saying they don't mean anything. What I'm getting at is people confuse intelligence with, let's say, being smart, being educated. All education is rote memory.
They're designed that they do indicate. They might not be perfect. The difference between a, 120 and a 90, there's a big difference there.
Right. 15 points is the standard deviation, and that's huge. It's the difference between somebody of average IQ and somebody slightly above an imbecile, for example, 100 going to 85. But what I'm getting at is people confuse intelligence with education. People that are more rational can determine if what they're being fed is likely true or not, whereas your typical person will just memorize it and parrot it back. That's education. Intelligence is about rational thinking, problem solving. And all I'm saying is some of the questions, not a lot, mainly in the language area, were added to gender norm the scores. There used to be a 12 to 15 point gap. So you can say that a lot of women have higher IQs than men. I can say that about blacks too, but you have to look at the averages and look at how we've evolved throughout time. Typically,
well, like I said, I like male leadership. I'm all for male leadership. I'm not, though, for the, I don't like the patriarchy, and I don't think you can change it by saying, well, it just means that men lead.
You can look it up, though, and one of the definitions you'll find is male leadership.
Yeah, but there's others, too. And people, that's not what most people have in mind when they say it.
Well, I thought it was. That's what most people
know. What does male leadership mean?
Well, throughout history, men, and this is where Tan was correct, have evolved to be more, again, these are general things. There's always exceptions, and there's overlap, but generally
I
to
totally
be more outward-facing.
I don't disagree with that.
They plan better. They're more outward-looking, whereas women have smaller circles. They're usually more focused on the immediate. It's easier for men to look at people in groups. Whereas women are more prone to look at individuals and have compassion. All these kind of differences are evolutionary. They are genetic. And that's why men are in a better position to generally be leaders. Okay?
I agree with that. Okay. Leadership is not patriarchy. Patriarchy
is.
Men own everything.
You
and
must have been around during the 60s when they were shouting, down with the patriarchy. Or in Urban's case, it's the Bible. You know, that's what turned you off to it, and I get it. Anyway, I want to move on because I don't think you're a feminist, okay? There's some things that you've said that were feminist-leaning, but I understand it. You were responding to some things that got you angry, and, for example, over at that site, he says, I don't hate women, but yet you look at some of the pictures there, and he's going out of his way to offend. And I'm not a person who is against offending people. You know, like, I don't worry about using the word nigger. I intend to offend. It's a word of contempt, and that's what I have. But these are our women, you know. So, like, one of the pictures there showed a woman in the kitchen, a little bubble there where she's thinking, oh, I'll have to ask my husband what to do, as if women can't even handle themselves in the kitchen, you know. And then saying that women can't contribute to his site anymore. Well, it's his site. He can do what he wants, but, well, does that make any sense? Look at what you're doing. Look at the woman in Germany now, something to do with the Holocaust there, an older lady going to prison over it. You know,
everybody loves her. Well, there's a blackout. There's a blackout on any information about her. You know, since her home was raided, we haven't heard another word about that. So
all I'm getting at is, of course, it makes sense to accept contributions from people who can effectively contribute. But where I agreed with Tan was when he said, you know, people will say, well, there's not enough women in the movement. I don't try to attract women, to water anything down, to attract weak men either, feminized men. I figure that when there's something of value there, when there's something of strength there, the women will come. But I think in the end, violence is going to be required at some point anyways, and I don't expect women to fight our battles. Although even then, when you talk about revolution, I expect that some women will play physical roles.
They always have, you know. And
I mean, we're in a worse situation than Israel, and they had to use women for a while in combat. I think they stopped that years ago. But what I'm getting at is we're in a worse situation, and when it comes time to fight, there's not going to be many men, you know, so anybody that we can take, including women, you know, there was only the two genders, right? Well, any way they can contribute, that's fine with me. I kind of got off track here.
We skipped a bunch of questions, but...
Right, you don't mind if I get back to some of those?
No.
See, I'm pretty sure I know what you'll say here, but do you think that the Jewish leadership... Do you think they're pursuing a white genocide agenda?
Well, you know, I don't like to say an outright yes to that. Of course, they are, but I would call it they want to control and dominate. That's their agenda, is to control and dominate whites, which would make whites less powerful. So if there's less of us, that makes us less powerful. I don't think they want to get rid of all white people, but it's the same thing because they want white Shabbos goys. You know, they want white people who will do either work for them, the smart one, work on their side, or if there's the other white people, if they're just quiet and totally subdued, and do their will. They want white people around who they can turn into slaves. It's really disgusting beyond belief to think about it if you are a proud white person.
Well, consider this, though. When I say genocide, I mean entire genetic biological elimination. Now, in the past, let's say North Africa, the Middle East, you know, what happened? Look at the Middle East now and North Africa. You know, it's all muddy now. There's not many whites left there. So now that process is going on in every white-founded country, is being flooded with non-whites. And at the same time, policies are in place to give preferential treatment to them and media propaganda to encourage us to race mix with them and incite them to violence against us. So over time, just by the numbers, genocide would have to be the result unless they were to switch their propaganda and start saying, save the white race. Because the whites have to be able to mate with each other. At some point, 50 years from now, it'll be hard for a white man to find a white woman. Because next door is a black guy, next door is a Hispanic, at his workplace is all blacks, and so the course they're on has to lead to genocide unless they switch it.
Well, it does. You're right. That's a powerful argument. But maybe they don't. Maybe they're not so clear about what they're doing. I mean, maybe they're
might
doing
just be instinctive
now, and they don't know exactly where it's going to end up. They might, you know, I don't know that they have everything plotted out,
planned
like God or something who knows exactly what the end is going to be and.
Well, they might just be doing what they instinctively do, although it's clear to me that they, at least some of them, have a white genocide agenda, but others, it just might be just their way, just what they do without without even trying.
Yeah, well, maybe it does end up being white genocide, because if whites are not pure white anymore, then they're gone, so they can't bring forth a pure white.
So if they wanted to save some whites to keep the system going, they would have to change course, let's say a few decades from now, and start putting out propaganda where it's okay for whites to have their own communities so that we can save them. You know what I mean? They would have to switch their entire course, their policies, all that.
I think, Bill, that there is not enough good talent working on behalf of the white race at all. If white people understood what whiteness means and that there wouldn't be any more white people, of course, a lot of people actually say, well, that's okay, because whites, we just cause trouble all the time, and we wouldn't have any racial trouble if we're all. Actually, there's a lot of them who do say that. That is pretty sick. Boy,
right.
I don't know. See, there again, it's our own people are nuts. Tan Staffa wouldn't like that, but. And maybe they've been made nuts, but it didn't make me nuts. They haven't made me nuts, although I haven't watched television. I haven't had a television since 1982.
That's a good thing.
It caused me to have a clear view of things.
Right. The people that are the most susceptible to the propaganda are your typical yokels who say, oh, that doesn't affect me, I see right through it. And the ones who are the least affected by it are the ones who realize how powerful it is and understand, for example, even somebody like myself or you, we can be negatively affected by it. So I don't expose myself to it. I don't have a YouTube. I don't want anything to do with it. Let me ask you. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Do you think there is any realistic way or possibility for pro-whites to obtain real power via voting? I'm talking here in the United States.
I would say, probably not. No, I didn't see any possibility for that. We've already talked about Donald Trump. I was just going to say, Donald Trump has shown up, and nobody expected him to show up, and you don't know what he might bring about, but you've already explained what. But you think that would be, he's only going to go so far. It's true.
And he's somebody that's just a baby step. I expect 10, 20 years down the road, or it could be, I can't predict the future, it could be in 5 years, that they will give attention to a white nationalist type party when things get bad enough and more whites are getting frustrated. And, of course, it will be, again, phony opposition, right, just like a lot of the nationalist parties in Europe. And then the whites will be tricked again. I'm talking a guy will get out there that really speaks pro-white. Trump hasn't spoken pro-white at all, not one sentence.
Well,
okay?
I'm
saying a guy who gets out there and says, I'm pro-white and I want to represent the interests of white people. They will, down the road, give attention to something like that as one of their final processes to the, finishing us off, so that whites can again be tricked and think we've got somebody sticking up for us, and then they'll put him in there, actually he won't win, but they'll at least think that they can still have faith in the political process because, hey, there's a white nationalist party for us, as if we could ever win that way. Let's see. Do you think there is a peaceful path to fending off the white genocide agenda, or let's say the anti-white agenda, a peaceful path to securing an existence for our people and a future for white children?
No, I don't think there's any peaceful path to getting rid of the Jew, and that's what needs to be done. We should be more specific. I think we should be talking about the Jew, and if Jews are parasites, indeed, then have parasites ever been fended off in nature? I mean, parasites are always around. So I don't know how this is done, but I think that we have to work with our own people. I did a program at the beginning of the year, and I've never picked up on that theme again. I was going to, but it was about if you don't have anything in you that is susceptible to a disease. It was about being alkaline. It said if a disease can't take hold in you, that's real health. Otherwise, you're always just fighting, your immune system's fighting something off. And if we didn't have anything in us that hosted the Jew, well, the Jew would have no power over us whatsoever. And this would be the foolproof way to be Jew-free.
I have immunity. You won't like this, but it's being anti-Christian.
Well, I
because
think
that's the pathogen
I'm
of Christianity.
Immune. But that's true because I've learned about it, and because maybe it's because I'm German and I'm very sensitive to what the Jews have done and are still doing to the Germans, so it makes me so disgusted that I really then hate them.
I've got another question for you. Going forward from where we are here and now, we kind of covered some of this, but...
Yeah, we did.
Should I skip that one?
Well, it's just, you know, just to reiterate, I guess, I was going to answer it that, you know, what is the best approach going forward? Well, as I already said, I think we need to reach our own people. And I want to thank you for not playing that usual hard metal music at the beginning of the program. I don't like that music, and I kind of felt like you wouldn't. And you played some very nice classical music. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah, I like certain classical music very much, and that was one of the selections I like, and I'll be playing another one on the way out, Bach, but it's operatic.
Good.
And so, yeah, I did that for you. And I do that on certain podcasts I do, like I did a series of 6 podcasts on intelligence, and they're the least listened to ones I ever did. But each one has an intro and outro that's classical. I was trying to be a little highbrow, but I do love classical, but I also like metal and all that.
Now that I've been on your show here, and I'm always looking for things to listen to because there's not very many radio programs being done now, and some of them I just don't even want to listen to. So I will go and look for those programs you did on intelligence and put them on while I'm working in the kitchen and so on.
Maybe they are up at TalkShoe there on the TalkShoe Might Is Right.
Yeah, I use your TalkShoe because I can't really figure out how to use your website.
They're not on the site here at mightisright.net, but I think they are on the TalkShoe thing. But in any case, eventually I'm going to get everything I ever did up on the site. It's just I don't have time. And anyway, are there any other thoughts you want to express on any topic at all?
Well, no, I really don't have any. I think I've talked a lot. I appreciate that. And I've enjoyed this very much, Bill. And I think I always did like you. I remember you from way back, and you have a nice way about you.
Do you remember our first communication? You called me an ass.
Well, what was it? I don't remember it.
Well, it was, I don't remember what podcast. Oh, yeah. It was when you were talking about over there at Renegade and how they interviewed Weber a couple times, and I was defending Kyle Hunt. But anyway, you misunderstood some of what I was saying, and so you called me an ass.
I do speak out too rudely sometimes. I realize that. If I don't stop and wait 15 minutes a day or something before I respond to something, you know, I can kind of overdo it. But
well,
I'm glad you brought that up because I'm going to go and look back for that. I was just so irritated. And
yeah.
I got in bad with him from that point on. He's never really liked me and never trusted me, Kyle Hunt, because I just came right on and said, well, you've got somebody on there. You don't know enough about it to be interviewing Mark Weber because you're agreeing with the things he's saying and you don't know that he's not telling the truth. And Kyle was really offended by that, really offended.
Yeah. Just so you know, I got how you might have misunderstood some things I was saying. You took them a different way, but I already had understood your personality. You know, some people say, oh, she's so abrasive, she's so easy to jump on people, but I actually like that about you. And so when you said that, when you wrote that, I just laughed and then explained myself. And by the end of it, you said I was a pretty nice guy.
Okay, see, I made up for it. I really appreciate that you're an easygoing, about things like that. Yeah, you try to understand where the person is really coming.
People have referred to me as being abrasive myself, so I can be that way, so I understand it in others. I kind of like that trait where sometimes you go off In fact, some people will criticize you for, infighting. Now, I don't mean like with the tan thing. A lot of people aren't going to be interested in that because it's, I don't consider it real important. I know it is to you too. But there's other people within the struggle that you have, and I'm not aware
Rodney
of all.
Rodney Martin?
Right, and some others that you have.
Well, just about everybody. You know, it is true I have criticized. I haven't gone off against everybody, but I have criticized a whole lot of people. It's true. When I look back, I see it. I see it there. I don't see what's wrong with that.
Well, I don't know about a whole lot. I was just aware of, let's say, like Weber, Clark, and a few others, right? And there's others that people have brought up that I didn't listen to those podcasts. But the ones I did listen to, as far as I was concerned, that needed to be said.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, some of these people need to be exposed. Some of them, I don't believe, are really on our side. Okay.
No, they're not, and I think there's a lot. We don't know how many people are agents, and, of course, it's real touchy if you start going around insinuating.
And you don't do that. You're pretty conservative on, accusations, but you're just bringing up certain things, and at least the ones I've heard, I thought it was productive to expose some of these people.
Well, all the people who are sympathetic to me, I guess you'd say, they all say that. You know, they don't say anything wrong with it. But there's a core, some of those people who say that, maybe not the ones you're talking about, but there are a lot of trolls around who try to make a big thing against me. And I finally realized that that's what that was all about.
Like I said, there's only three that I ever will talk about. Actually, now I guess I added Aglin. This is the first time I've mentioned him on air. But I talk about what's going on over there. I've done it frequently. I would say at this popular site, at one of the most popular sites, I wouldn't name it. I would just be commenting on some of the things I would run across there. Usually I don't mention anybody, but there's three. And all three of those, no, two of those three you have done podcasts on. And then there's other people that I'm glad that you do it because I don't want to do it. I just have a policy that other than these three particular snakes, I leave all the other snakes up to you.
Well, that's what a lot of people do. Yeah, you know, I think when you talk about my role, I think I've served that purpose quite well, doing what other people don't want to do and criticizing people in the movement.
Right.
And I'm particularly proud of the work that I did on Rodney Martin, and I have to thank a certain person who emailed me about it, alerting me to this newspaper article about him. And then I went from there. So, I think what I did was quite important. Where would Rodney Martin be now? He's gone now. He's kind of gone. And people miss him because they thought he was doing a good job. Well, I know that he wasn't because I know enough about what National Socialism is all about. And he was just hitting the surface there. And he's just an opportunist, you know? He's an opportunist looking. Why people want to get into this movement? Here's the question I have, Bill. And I don't have an answer for it. It's why people would want to get into this movement when they can do other things. I don't know, like Rodney Martin. He never made any sense. Maybe you don't never pay any attention to him either.
I was interviewed on, I can't think of the guy's name now. He was one of the people that did a podcast on that, what was it, American Nationalist Network at Blog Talk. One of the guys from Britain there interviewed me one time. I thought it would just be me and this guy, but Rodney came in there a lot. I guess he ran the studio for the guy that was just like calling in or something. I don't know. Maybe he didn't have a computer. But in any case, I had to, talk with him there. But, I've been over at his site.
Yeah,
he's got
Dave,
that one.
What's his name? Dave Jones?
Yeah, David Jones.
David Jones, yeah.
But anyway, over on his site there, he had that one section called The Reading Room. I find it funny that he says himself, why would anyone want to get involved in this movement when there's so many charlatans, so much infighting, so much bickering, so much calling everybody a Jew? But yet that's what he, specializes in. Now, many of the people he attacked, actually the site's been down a while, but before you go to that reading room, many of the people he would attack deserved to be attacked, and much of what he said was justified, but then he would throw in things that aren't true. And then he'll attack people he shouldn't be attacking. And then all you have to do is look at who he associates with, one of those other snakes that we brought up tonight. up on his site there.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, he's trouble. I don't know what he's up to, but it's not good.
Yeah, well, that's a role that I've played. And, you know, I'm a natural critic. I'm not out to get people. I don't think so. I don't feel that way. But I just see things through a critical lens. I come by that naturally. My father was pretty sharp at seeing people and so on. And I just do that. So you could call my role partly that of the critic. And when it comes to Third Reich Germany, I'm not very critical, I guess.
Right. In the end, the bickering and people, you know, exposing other people, saying what they think, in the end, you know, the more rational people will be able to figure out what's going on, and maybe the better elements can rise to the top, you know. But
yeah, well, I don't think it's a terrible thing. I think what would be terrible if nobody ever says anything or criticizes anybody and everything's allowed, then I think that's the worst scenario.
Yeah, I'm fine with fighting it out, but when you talk about the movement and why would people want to enter it, see, I have a totally different way of looking at it. In fact, I call it, and I didn't come up with that, but the struggle, since I don't think there really is a movement, it's, you know, you've heard that, struggling to get moving, because there isn't one, and I don't think there should be one in terms of out there with lots of organizations. The people who want to do that, that's fine. There can be multifaceted approaches, but that's not what I'm trying to do at all, and I wish that more people that had larger reach would start focusing on trying to reach the reachable that will not be part of any movement in terms of joining an organization, getting their membership card. You know, what do they say? Stand up and be counted, show your face, come out. Well, I'm recommending the opposite thing, especially for young people, and preparing. But they can't infiltrate individuals.
Yeah. I'm glad there's people like you, Bill, and I don't even want to talk about anything like that. I think I should stick with revisionism. And the last thing I'd want to say is I still think that if people talked more about Holocaust revisionism and made fun of the Holocaust and there was a lot more about it, I think we might be able to succeed there. There are people who are giving their whole lives up for this cause. That's not enough because it takes more people making noise about it, intelligent noise. So that's where I stand. And I know you agree. I mean, you agree with me about the Holocaust, that you see how important it is.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I love what you're doing, and you know, it's just not my thing, and I don't feel that everyone needs to know as much, you know, but they do, I think, do need to know the basics. It's very important, and so when I, you know, want to, well, I had already researched it before I ran across you, but I learned a lot of things I didn't know from you, so,
okay.
You know, when I want to look into that or send somebody to learn about, I send them to you, you know, and in fact, I should add your site. You won't get many hits from me. I don't reach a lot of people, but I should add your site there for on that general subject, because all I have on that whole period is, well, that documentary, Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. I have that link there. Did you like that?
No.
You didn't?
You know, I was not able to promote that. But that's because, see, I'm particular about things, and I didn't like the beginning of it. I didn't like that actor. I don't like to see Adolf Hitler portrayed by actors. They're never right. They're never any good. And I thought this actor seemed like a real weak, kind of a overly emotional type. And yet the idea is good. I'm sure it has reached a whole lot of people and changed people's minds. I understand that. So
I loved it, but I didn't really like that part with the actor anyways. But there were certain parts I didn't like where it was kind of playing into the narrative from the other side. I can't remember specifics, but like even maybe some parts showing how friendly they were to blacks or something. There was criticism, just like they do with Russia today, playing that white guilt card, you know, how the Germans treated black people better than Americans did, that kind of thing. I didn't like those things.
The people who did that, it's our anti-racist. That's
right.
All there is to it, you know, and that anti-racism comes through.
But anyway, it covered the main high points of the greatness, I think, of Hitler, so, and of National Socialism in that period. So I thought it was pretty good.
You're right. It is. If people see it, they're going to get a whole lot out of it.
Very emotional.
Yeah.
And let me ask you one more thing. That damn anti-racist Hitler. And I understand it does good, but what do you think of that video? Have you seen that anti-racist cartoon?
Yeah, that doesn't turn me on. I'm a purist, and so that's supposed to do something. I don't know, but I don't like it because I don't like, again, even though it's in a cartoon form, I don't like the way Hitler is portrayed.
I thought you wouldn't like, what I don't like about it is it's playing into the, now I understand for lemmings, there's a thing in politics where they say, how does that go? They'll say that perception is reality. In other words, if you don't control the media and all that, you have to go with where people are at, with their perceptions of things, and try to move them where you want from there, you know. But anyway, I don't like it because I don't try to do that. I'm not trying to reach the masses. I'm trying to reach people who can think. And so, therefore, I don't like it in the video where they're taking the kind of anti-racist narrative as if racism is a bad thing.
Yeah.
And now we're playing Hitler like he's Mr. Evil. I just don't like the way that they're twisting that. I don't know. I can't explain it well.
No, I don't either. I don't like any anti-racism. Because I think that race is the key thing. It's so important, and it needs to be preserved. Our race needs to be preserved. That's the most important thing. That's what's so wrong with immigration, that people are bound. They're bound to marry one another when you get so many all these different people mixed together. A lot of it's going to happen.
Right.
If with this Trump thing, I can't help but have hope for this, that we could repeal that 14th Amendment. How terrific that would be.
I'd bet you everything that I own, and all you'd have to do is put up $10. That's not going to happen.
kind
of surprised that you would think so.
Well, I'm just saying it would be great if it... Well, I'll have to think about that.
Well, first off, that would require the entire process, right, that's under enemy control. So, and I don't think that they want that, so it's not going to happen.
There's a number of these candidates who are on record as being opposed to the 14th Amendment. And it's always been, it's been kind of controversial. So, well, that's really not the subject of our program. So I'm sorry for bringing that up again. I think I need to go. I'm getting
okay.
Tired.
Yeah, I'm sorry I took so much of your time. Yeah, all right. So thanks for coming on. I enjoyed it, and I think the listeners will too, and it'll be educational as well.
And I thank you, and I'm glad that I got to know you a little bit better, Bill.
All right. Thanks a lot, and
okay.
have a good evening the rest
all
of
right.
it. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Carolyn Yeager. Oh,